introducing our guest, Dr. Richard Stallman. And he is he's well known, as this crowd is telling. He launched the development of the GNU operating system in 1984. GNU is free software. Everyone has the freedom to copy and redistribute it, as well as to make changes, either large or small. The GNU Linux system, basically the GNU operating system with Linux added, is used in tens of millions of computers today. Stallman has received the ACM Grace Hopper Award, MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, the Electronic Frontier Foundation Pioneer Award, and the Takeda Award for Social Economic Betterment, as well as several honorary doctorates. So, please, it's a great pleasure.
Please raise your hands if you cannot hear me. Well, I guess the system's working then. I don't see any hands. What is free software? Free software is software that respects the user's freedom. Typical software distributed to the public is proprietary software, non-free software, which tramples the user's freedom. It's distributed in a scheme that keeps the users divided and helpless. Divided because each one is forbidden to share with anyone else, and helpless because the users don't have the source code, so they can't change anything. They can't even independently verify what the program is really doing. And it's not unusual for non-free programs to contain malicious features. But free software respects the user's freedom. What does that mean? It's not enough to say, I'm in favor of freedom. We have to talk about which freedoms are important. Free software means the user has four essential freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program however you wish. Freedom one is the freedom to help yourself. That's the freedom to study the source code and change it to do what you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor. That's the freedom to distribute copies to others. And freedom three is the freedom to help your community. That's the freedom to publish modified versions so others can get the benefit of your contribution. If you have all four of these freedoms, the software is free. It's free software. And that means it's treating you in a way that respects your freedom. If any one of these freedoms is substantially missing, it is non-free software, it's unethical, it shouldn't be developed, and you shouldn't use it. But why are these four freedoms essential? Why should we define free software this way? Freedom two is essential on basic ethical grounds, so that you can live an ethical life, be a good member of your community. If you use a program that does not give you freedom two, the freedom to help your neighbor, the freedom to distribute copies to others, then you are in danger of falling into a moral dilemma at any moment. Whenever some friend asks you, could I have a copy of that program? Because at that point, you're going to have to choose between two evils. One evil is to make a copy for your friend and violate the license of the program. And the other evil is to deny your friend a copy and comply with the license of the program. Now, if you are in this situation, you ought to choose the lesser evil. The lesser evil is to make a copy for your friend and violate the license of the program. the lesser evil, because in this case, the evil, which consists of violating an agreement that you were pressured into making, falls on someone who has acted in an evil fashion, who has attacked the solidarity of your community. And thus, if you have to do evil to someone, let it be him. But being the lesser evil does not mean it is good. Because this is still one more copy of a non-free program. And it's not really a good thing to be making agreements and then violating them. The only thing in the field of software that's worse than an unauthorized copy of a proprietary program is an authorized copy of that proprietary program. Because that attacks people's freedom and rewards the perpetrator of the scheme. So, once you have understood this reasoning, what you should really do is avoid being in the dilemma in the first place. Now, there are two ways you can avoid being in this moral dilemma. One is, don't have any friends. And the other is, don't use the non-free program. Don't, but by refusing to accept a copy and use it, you avoid taking the first step down the path that leads you to the choice, to the moral dilemma, to having to choose one evil or another. Once John Perry Barlow gave a speech and he asked the audience, raise your hand if you have no unauthorized copies of software. And he was surprised to see a hand go up. And then he saw it was me, and he laughed. And he laughed and said, oh, of course, you, Stallman, because he understood why. All my copies of software are authorized because they're all free software. If someone offers me a program, if I promise not to share it with you, I'm going to tell him no. Because that's unethical. It would be unethical of course it's unethical for him to ask for such a promise, but it would be unethical for me to give it as well. The most important resource of any society is not a physical resource, it's a psychosocial resource. It's the spirit of goodwill, the spirit of helping your neighbor. This resource, the level of this resource, makes the difference between a livable society and a dog-eat-dog jungle. It's no coincidence that the world's major religions have promoted this spirit of goodwill and helping your neighbor for thousands of years. Because even a small increase in the level of this spirit of goodwill makes life better for everyone. So what does it mean when powerful social institutions say that it's wrong to share with your neighbor? What are they doing? They're poisoning this essential resource, something that no society can afford. And what does it mean when they say that if you share with your neighbor, you're a pirate? They are equating helping your neighbor with attacking ships. Something that is the complete opposite of morality, because attacking ships is very bad, but helping your neighbor is admirable. And they should be encouraging this. And what does it mean when they impose harsh punishments on people who are caught sharing with their neighbors? How much fear will it take before your neighbors are too scared to share with you and before you're too scared to share with them? In two countries already, the proprietary software developers have threatened the public with being raped for having unauthorized copies of proprietary software. And I think that when they start threatening rape, the term terror campaign is justified. And I believe that these terrorists should be made to stop. So that's the reason for freedom two, the freedom to help your neighbor, the freedom to make copies and distribute them to others. Freedom zero is necessary for a different reason, so you can control your own computer. There are actually proprietary programs that restrict how you're allowed to run them. They restrict how much you can run them, or who's allowed to run them on your computer, or what purposes you can run them for. And obviously, this is not having control of your computer. But freedom zero is not enough to have control of your computer, because that's only the freedom to do whatever the developer chose for you. To really have control of your computer, you need freedom one, which is the freedom to read the source code and see what the program does and then change it if you don't like it. Then you, rather than someone else, decide what your computer can do. If you don't have freedom one, you can't even tell what the program is really doing. And many non-free programs have malicious features designed to spy on the user, annoy the user, interfere with the user, or even attack the user. For instance, one non-free program, whose name you may have heard of, that spies on the user, is called Windows XP. When the user of this program, I won't say you because I hope you wouldn't use software like this, when the user of this program searches in his own files for some word, Windows sends a message to Microsoft saying what word he searched for. This is one spy feature. It's not the only one. When Windows XP asks for an upgrade, it sends a report to Microsoft with a list of all the software installed on the machine. A second spy feature. But spying is not limited to Windows. Windows Media Player is also spyware. Whatever the user looks at, it reports. Total surveillance. But please don't think that the only proprietary software developer who would do this nasty thing is Microsoft. Because RealPlayer has the same feature. And so does the TiVo. Now, the TiVo is an interesting case because it contains a lot of free software. It contains a small GNU/Linux operating system. And a lot of people in the free software community applauded it because they said, it's using our software. But so what? It may have been using our software, but it wasn't respecting the user's freedom. It contains non-free software too. And part of that spies on you. Not you, sorry. You wouldn't use a program like this. Then there are the features that are designed to annoy the user. For instance, there are some non-free programs that change the configuration of the machine, perhaps to make it display advertisements from then on. The developers figure that the users won't know how to undo this change. And then there's the functionality of refusing to function, often known as DRM, Digital Restrictions Management, where the program says, I don't want to show you this file. No, I won't let you copy 10 lines out of this file. No, I won't print this file for you. You're not good enough for that program. It's designed not to do what you want. It's designed to do what somebody else wants. And then there are back doors. Now, I entered this room by a back door, I think. What did I can't remember, actually. You know, at this point, I don't even remember where I came from. But I'm talking about back doors in your computer system. One non-free program that contains a back door that you might perhaps have heard of is called Windows XP. You see, when Windows XP asks for an upgrade, it tells Microsoft who the user is. So Microsoft could give him an upgrade designed specifically for him, which means with whatever nastiness it wants to put in, perhaps some secret remote login accounts, perhaps it just won't run at all. And there's very little the user can do if this should happen. Now, that's the back door we know about, because we can deduce it from the things we know. A year ago in India, people told me that some Indian programmers working on Windows XP had been arrested and accused of working for Al-Qaeda at the same time and trying to put in a back door that Microsoft wasn't supposed to know about. Well, apparently that attempt failed. Was there another attempt that succeeded? I don't know. And you don't know. We can't find out. There's no way to check. Now, I won't claim that all proprietary software developers deliberately put in malicious features. There are those that try to make a program that will be good to use. But they're all human, so they all make mistakes. They design features thinking the users will like them, but the users don't like them. Or they introduce bugs into the code, unknowingly. And the users are just as helpless against mistakes as they are against deliberate malicious features. Because the users are helpless because they don't have the source code. The users of a non-free program are prisoners of their software. We free software developers are also human. We also make mistakes. We design features you don't like. We introduce bugs. Every program that's non-trivial has bugs. The difference is that we don't keep you the prisoner of our decisions or our mistakes. We respect your freedom. And anything we do, if you don't like it, you can change it. But freedom one is not enough for all computer users to have control over their computers. First of all, I guess so. Is the other one working now? I doubt it. I didn't. I'll treat you right, I promise. Freedom one is not enough. Freedom one is the freedom to personally study the source code and change it to do what you want. This is not enough because there are millions of people who use computers but don't know how to program. They can't directly, personally exercise freedom one. But even for us programmers, freedom one is not enough because there's just too much software. There's too much free software for any one programmer to read it all and master it all and make all the changes she might want. The only way we can really take control of our software, of our computers, is to work together, to do it jointly. And for that, we need freedom three. Freedom three is the freedom to help your community. It's, are you feeling, do you have a headache, dear? Yeah, it's not saying anything now.
It's not free software.
Power cycling, it seems to fix the problem for a moment. So, freedom three is the freedom to publish a modified version so that others can benefit from your changes. And this makes it possible for us to work together to change the software to do what we want. For instance, suppose that most users would like a certain program to progress in a certain direction. Well, somebody will make a change that goes part way, and we'll release his modified version. And of course, most people will switch to it. And then someone else will make a change starting from there, taking it further in that direction, and publish her modified version, and most people will switch to it. And so on. A series of different people contributing.
Getting a new battery.
Is someone getting a battery? That's good. So, in this way, many people can work together to make progress and turn the program into what we want it to be. If there are a million people who would like a certain change, then just by chance we could expect a few thousand of them know how to program. Sooner or later, a few of them will make the change, publish. Should I just continue?
Yes.
And can you get my voice on the recording even
yes.
without this?
Yes, we get it without.
Can you hear me in the back there?
Yes.
Well, that's good. So, sooner or later, a few of them will make this change and publish their modified version, and all these millions of people who like the change will switch to it. So they'll all get what they want, but only a few of them had to do the work. And this includes many, many non-programmers who wouldn't have known how to make the change themselves. But they get the benefit of the fact that other people had these freedoms. So when some people exercise these freedoms, lots of other people benefit. In some ways, this is like freedom of the press. Most people never write articles for publication. So they're not directly exercising their freedom of the press, but they all get the benefit of the fact that others have freedom of the press, and that various different opinions can be published. What if there are just 1,000 people who would like a certain change? And what if none of them knows how to program? They can still take advantage of freedom. One of them can make an announcement and say, I would like this change. Who else would like this change? So these 1,000 people will get in touch with each other. And then they can start an organization, and they can all join, which means they all have to put in some money. If every user puts in $100, the organization will have $100,000. And that's enough to pay a few programmers to work for a year. So they can make quite a bit of change. Now, when this organization is looking for which programmers will do the work, it can talk to a programming company and say, what will you charge to do this work, and when can you have it done? And if they don't like the answer, they can ask another programming company, what will you charge and when can you have it done? Which illustrates the fact that free software means there is a free market for all kinds of support and services. By contrast, the support for a proprietary program is typically a monopoly because only the developer has the source code. So only the developer can make any change, no matter how small. And the users have to beg, please make this change for me. Please pay attention to me. Which is a humiliating situation to be in. Sometimes the developer says, pay us and we'll listen while you report the problem. And if the user does that, the developer says, thank you, in 6 months there will be an upgrade. Buy the upgrade and you'll see if we fix this problem and you'll see what new problems we have in store for you. But with free software, there's a free market for support because anyone who has a copy is free to study the source code and master it and offer support. And thus, for those users that value good support and are willing to pay for it, they can expect to get better support for their money, in general, with free software. Now, usually we think that when there is a choice of products available, that means there is not a monopoly. But paradoxically, this is not true in the case of a choice of proprietary programs. A choice between proprietary programs is a choice between monopolies. If the user makes the mistake of choosing this proprietary program, the support for it afterward will be this monopoly. If the user unfortunately chooses this proprietary program, the support for it afterward will be this monopoly. And if the user is foolish enough to choose this proprietary program, the support for it will be this monopoly. So it's a choice between monopolies. And this illustrates an important principle. Freedom is something much bigger than having a choice between a few fixed options. Freedom should not be equated to freedom of choice. Freedom means having control of your own life. To have a choice between proprietary programs is to have a choice of who will be your master. Freedom means not having a master. So I've explained the reasons for the four essential freedoms. If a program gives you these four essential freedoms, it's free software. And that means the developer is treating you ethically, respecting your freedom, and it's legitimate to use the program. If it does not respect your freedom, if the features of the program are bait for people to give up their freedom and for people to promise not to share with you, then it's an attack on social solidarity, and it shouldn't exist. In 1983, I came to the basic ideas of what I've just been telling you. And I decided I wanted to live in freedom, which meant to escape from non-free software. But in 1983, there was no easy way to do that. Well, I could stop using computers, then I would escape from non-free software, but that would be going into exile from my field. And I wanted to fight to liberate it, not just give up and run away. But what could I do? It was impossible to use a computer in freedom in 1983, because the computer won't do anything without an operating system, and all the operating systems for the modern computers of the day were proprietary. The user had to sign a non-disclosure agreement just to get the executables, and the source code was not available to ordinary users. So what could I do? I was one man, not famous, not rich. I didn't imagine I might be able to persuade governments or corporations to start respecting the user's freedom. But there was one thing I was very good at, and that was writing software. And I discovered a way I could solve this problem by writing software. The problem existed because all the operating systems were proprietary. Well, I was an operating system developer. If I wrote another operating system and said to everyone, you can use this operating system in freedom, this would give people a way to use computers in freedom. When I realized that this was possible, I saw it was probably going to be the most important thing I'd ever get a chance to do in my life. And I concluded I had been elected by circumstances to do this job. I was aware of the problem, and I could see that in general other people were not paying attention to it. I had the skill to try to solve this problem, and probably no one else was going to try if I did not. So I had to do it. It's as if you see someone drowning and you know how to swim, and it's not Bush. or any of those Norwegian politicians that are proposing to legislate DRM in Norway. Then you have a moral duty to save that person. Well, I don't know how to swim, but I do know how to write software, and in this case, that's the job that needed doing. So I decided I would develop a free software operating system or die trying, presumably of old age. Because at the time, the free software movement that I was just launching did not have enemies. Nobody was making any efforts to prevent us from developing a free software operating system. It's just that it was a lot of work. And nobody, including me, knew if we would ever have an entire free operating system. But I was determined at least to try. This decision led to other decisions, technical design decisions. What kind of system should it be? Well, I knew it would take years to develop an operating system, and during that time, computers would change. I didn't want the system to be obsolete before it was finished, so it had to be portable. But I knew of just one successful portable operating system, and that was Unix. So I decided to follow the design of Unix. I figured that way there'd be a better chance that the system would really work and really be portable. In addition, users don't like incompatible changes. I realized that more people would use the system if I made it upward compatible with a popular system, such as Unix. So I decided to make it upward compatible with Unix. But this decided all the initial design decisions. You see, Unix consists of many components that communicate through interfaces that were more or less documented, and the users use the same interfaces. So to be compatible with Unix, you have to keep the same interfaces and replace the components one by one, which meant that the initial decisions were made, the remaining decisions were within one component, and they could wait. Whoever wrote that component could make them. So the only thing I needed to start this project was a name. In the community of programmers who programmed mainly for joy, although we were also getting paid, in the 1970s that I participated in, we often liked to choose funny or even naughty names for our programs. Because imagining the users laughing at the name is half the fun. And we had a specific tradition. When you were developing a program that was similar to some existing program, and that's a job that was very often necessary back then because programming was not portable, you would see some nice program on some other kind of computer system. The only way you could have anything like that was to write your own. So when you were doing that, our tradition was you could give it a name that's a recursive acronym, which says that your program is not the other one. So in 1975, I developed the first extensible text editor, Emacs. You could reprogram it during your editing session. And this was imitated many times, and some of the imitations were called this or that Emacs, but one was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs. And there was sign for sign is not Emacs, and Aina for Aina is not Emacs, and mince for mince is not complete Emacs. And then version 2 of Aina was called Zwei, for Zwei was Aina initially. So you can have lots of fun with recursive acronyms. I looked for a recursive acronym for something is not Unix, but I couldn't find one, and I realized that trying to make a longer word was not going to help. But then I thought, well, what if I make it shorter? What if I make a contraction? Then I could get a three-letter recursive acronym. I started trying every letter, ANU, BNU, KNU, DNU, ENU, FNU, GNU. Well, GNU is the funniest word in the English language, used for a lot of wordplay. I couldn't resist. Well, why is the word GNU used for so much wordplay? The reason is, according to the dictionary, it's pronounced new. So people started asking their friends, hey, what's GNU, instead of hey, what's new? There was even a funny song based on the word GNU when I was a child. So much humor in this word, I couldn't resist. So nowadays, if somebody asks you, what's GNU, there's a new answer. You can give them, you can say, GNU's not Unix. And the best part is, it sounds like you're obnoxiously telling the person what it isn't, instead of telling him what it is. But the fact is, you are telling him what it is. You're giving him the exact correct answer. It only seems like you're being obnoxious and saying what it isn't. But when it's the name of our system, please do not obey the dictionary. If you talk about the new operating system, you'll get people very confused. You see, we've been working on it for 21 years now, so it's not new anymore. But it still is and always will be GNU, no matter how many people pronounce it Linux by mistake. So during the 1980s, our work was to develop all the pieces we needed for this operating system. Once in a while, someone else released a program as free software that would do one of the jobs. And whenever that happened, we used it. You know, some people said the job was so big we'd never finish it. I thought there was a chance we'd finish it, but clearly it was big. We had to look for shortcuts. We couldn't afford an attitude of not invented here. So whenever someone else released a free program that was suitable, we used it. Well, I decided to use it. I'm the chief nuisance, so I was the one making those decisions. But that only happened occasionally by chance. So most of these components we had to develop. By 1991, we had almost all of them. Only one major essential component was still missing, and that was the kernel. The kernel is the program that allocates the machine's resources to all the other programs that you run. Now, we started developing a kernel in 1990. I found a way that I thought we would get the job done sooner. I found a microkernel called Mach that had been developed as a funded project at a university. And we just would have to write the top half of the kernel as a bunch of user programs that would run on top of Mach. And I thought, well, if we can debug them as user programs, it'll be easier to get them running. We should be able to have this thing running very quickly. I don't know why, because I didn't have, once I had chosen that design, that very general design, I didn't do the work on it. I don't know why, but it took many years to get our kernel to run at all. And it still doesn't run very well. So people aren't using it. But fortunately, we didn't have to wait for that, because in 1991, a Finnish college student named Linus Torvalds wrote his own kernel. He used the traditional monolithic design, and he got it to work within a year. Barely work, but enough for people to start to use it some. Initially, this kernel, which was called Linux, was not free software. But in 1992, he changed the license, adopting a particular free software license that I had written, the GNU General Public License. And therefore, it was free software. There are many other free software licenses, by the way. Free software is not defined as software under the GNU General Public License. It's defined by the four freedoms, as I told you earlier. Anyway, once Linux was free software, it was possible to make a complete free operating system as GNU plus Linux. And that is the system that began to catch on in 1992, and the system that you will hear many people mistakenly referring to as Linux. But it's really basically GNU. The development of Linux, the kernel, was an introduction to our community. That was the step that carried us across the finish line. Before that, we had many pieces of the GNU system, and some of them were useful by themselves. People would install them on top of their other operating system and run them, and they would be GNU fans, and they'd be using the software and maybe contributing too. But after Linux filled the last gap, we had a complete free operating system that you could install in a bare computer. And it was possible to use a PC in freedom. The goal that I had announced in 1983 was, after some 9 years of, 9 years later, achieved. However, the confusion of thinking that the entire system was Linux was a serious blow to the free software movement. You see, before that, the people who would take individual GNU programs and use them were, they knew that they were using GNU programs. So that a lot of them were fans of GNU. And when they read the articles that described our philosophy, the philosophy of the free software movement, which is what I've been telling you today, they would pay attention. They wouldn't all agree with us, but at least they would read it seriously and think about it. But once people started using essentially the whole GNU system, but thinking it was Linux, then when they see our articles, they often say, what's that got to do with me? That's the philosophy of GNU, and I'm a Linux user. In other words, our system, with Linux added, is leading people to the philosophy associated with the name Linux instead of the philosophy associated with the name GNU. And the philosophy associated with the name Linux is the apolitical philosophy, to use Linus Torvalds' words, or I might call it amoral. Which doesn't consider this an ethical issue at all. Linus Torvalds never agreed with this philosophy, and still doesn't. He thinks non-free software is legitimate. He even uses it in a very public way in the development of Linux, and I have criticized him for this publicly, because I think he's setting a very bad example for the community. Well, Torvalds has a right to his views, and he has a right to state his views. What's not right is when people attribute our work to him and think it's a proof of the validity of his views. So I want people to know that the system is the GNU system with Linux as the kernel, so that they will know why this system exists. This is partly a matter of credit. The developers of the GNU system, thousands of us, ought to get the credit for doing the biggest part of this job. But there's something, but credit after all is just a matter of ego, and it's not that important. What's really important here is teaching people about freedom. When people find out that they're using the GNU system, then later on they'll read about GNU and they will see that they are using an operating system which is the result of a sustained campaign for freedom. And that might make them think about freedom. Most operating systems were developed either for technical reasons or for commercial reasons. The GNU system was developed for ethical, social, political reasons. And its users need to know this, because one thing history teaches us is that freedom does not automatically perpetuate itself. In order to keep our freedom, we have to be prepared to defend it over and over. But in order for people to defend their freedom, they have to value it. And in order for people to value their freedom, they have to recognize what it is. And in our community, we're still at the stage of teaching people to recognize what it is. Most of the users of the GNU plus Linux operating system don't know anything about these ideas of freedom. They've never heard these ideas. What they have heard are completely different ideas. They've heard that this operating system is good because it's powerful and reliable and you can get it cheap. And those are the only reasons they've ever heard. No one has ever spoken to them about freedom. No one has ever raised this issue for them. In our community, there are thousands of people trying to convince more users to switch to the system, mostly citing the kinds of practical grounds that they think users already care about. and not trying to teach the users to care about something deeper and more important, which is the freedom to have a community. But if we don't teach people about this, how are they going to know? Are we depending on each person to figure it out for herself? Only a fraction of people will do that. When I point this out, sometimes some people tell me, well, I think we should go about it in two stages. First, let's convince them to try free software and use it, or try GNU/Linux and then use it. And then we can teach them about freedom. Well, that two-stage approach might work if it were seriously tried. But what's happening is lots of people are working on stage one, and only a few of us are working on stage two. And today, we face an additional obstacle because many of the people who talk about our work don't even call it free software. Many of them call it open source, which is the slogan of a different philosophy, a philosophy that explicitly says that this is just an issue of practical convenience, a philosophy that denies that the choice between free and non-free software is a matter of ethical versus unethical conduct, that denies that this is an issue of freedoms that users are entitled to. Instead, they say that they recommend a development methodology which invites many people to participate in the development, and they say that this development methodology typically leads to more powerful, reliable software. Well, maybe that's true. If it's true, that's a nice bonus. If freedom can also lead to practical benefits, that's a nice bonus. But that's not what decides whether freedom is important or not. So what the open source philosophy says is not wrong, but it's missing the most important point. It fails to teach people that there's an issue of freedom here. So of course it fails to teach people to value their freedom. And the result is that our community is weak. Our community is very broad now, with tens of millions of users. But most of these users have never seen the reasons to consider this an important issue. They've never seen arguments other than shallow practical ones. And that's why I now focus on raising these issues, on spreading the philosophy of free software. There are around a million contributors to free software now. So the community doesn't need me very much as a programmer anymore. But it does need me, or rather I can contribute a more necessary contribution by teaching people about the issues of freedom. And you can join and help. And one very easy way that you can help is by calling the system GNU/Linux and correcting other people who call it Linux. Of course, that's not enough to explain philosophical issues to people. You can't explain a philosophical issue in a second. You can say GNU/ in a second. And that, while it doesn't explain the issue, it helps prepare the people to pay attention when we explain the issue. So if a person knows the system that he's using is the GNU/Linux system, then when he sees our statements about the philosophy behind the GNU project, the philosophy of the free software movement, he's likely to pay more attention. And thus, your easy work that takes just 1 second will multiply the effectiveness of the articles and speeches that take us hours to write or to speak. Teaching people about freedom is all the more important today because today we face opposition, we face threats. Today we have something that we didn't have before. We have enemies, powerful corporations and their pet governments. Like their puppet government in the United States, which in regard to international legal issues does whatever the corporations tell it to do. One of the threats we face comes from hardware whose specifications are secret. How are we going to write free software to run that hardware if we can't find out what the commands are to make the hardware operate? And these problems have grown to be very large because our community was weak. Today, there are essentially no high-speed graphics chips available that we can find out how to program. How did it get this way? It wasn't always this way. When some companies started doing this, if millions of users had told that company, "We won't buy from you if you don't cooperate with free software," they would have stopped. But the millions of users of GNU/Linux didn't say that. Because this company said, "We, quote, support Linux," unquote. And what they meant was that they provide a non-free driver that you can load into your GNU/Linux system, and it'll run their hardware, but it will not run their hardware with free software. So yes, the hardware works if you don't mind giving up your freedom. And because our community was not educated about the issue of freedom, they let it go on. We could have made them stop if only we had all stood up and said stop. But we didn't, because we didn't, most of us didn't know, understand the issue or even think about it. The future of our community depends on what we value, whether we value convenience more or freedom more. That's what will decide our future. And this is one instance where our failure to care about freedom in large numbers gave us a present, which is bad for our freedom. But in addition, we face laws that explicitly prohibit free software. Now, one of these laws in the US is called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And this law prohibits anything that can be used to bypass DRM. Now, DRM itself is an attack on your freedom. When governments pass laws prohibiting bypassing DRM, these governments are saying that they are against your freedom and on the side of those who want to restrict you. So they are taking a very clear side, and the side that they're taking is against the people. That's what the US government has done. And this law was used in the United States to censor free software, such as, for instance, the free software to read the video off a DVD. Now, the format of video on a DVD was originally secret, and this was part of a scheme to restrict the public. In order to make a DVD player, the manufacturer had to sign a contract promising that the DVD player would restrict the public in certain ways. And only then could the manufacturer find out the specs of the format. But then some programmers in Europe figured out the specifications and released a free program, which made it possible to watch the movie on a DVD using free software. And this software was censored in the US. It's been driven underground. So if you are in the United States, I hope you will not be in the United States. It's a country that does not respect civil liberties in general. But if you're in the United States, one one right that you still supposedly have is, if you buy a DVD, is the right to watch it. However, the free software that would enable you to watch it on your free GNU/Linux system has been driven underground. And as a result, the only lawfully available software that could be used is proprietary, and it runs on proprietary systems. Now, this is one very specific application, but this alone might convince millions of users to choose proprietary operating systems in the future if they want to be able to watch DVDs on their computer. Now, the European Union adopted a directive that does more or less the same thing as the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the US, and most of the countries of Europe have now prohibited such software. But Norway has not yet made its decision. The government of Norway recently announced plans to prohibit DECSS here. But you can still demand that they respect your freedom. When politicians propose or support such laws, they're taking the side of multinational corporations against the citizens of Norway. And this betrayal must not go unpunished, must not go unrecognized. A strong movement on your part can show them that they better not take a side against the citizens of their country. But you have to show them that they won't like it, that they'll lose if they do this. You have to show them that your freedom matters to you. I should read to you the arrogant statement of the record companies, which also want this law, so that they can attack your freedom. Record companies are starting to distribute corrupt discs instead of, they look like compact discs, but they're not real compact discs. They do not follow the specification. And here's what EMI said to its customers in Germany a year or two ago. If you plan to continue protesting about future audio media releases with copy protection, forget it. Copy protection is a reality, and within a matter of months, more or less, all audio media worldwide are copy protected. And this is a good thing for the music industry. In order to make this happen, we will do anything within our power, whether you like it or not. This, by the way, is a translation from the German. And I'm told that the original German is much nastier, but that it's hard to do justice to it in English. So what do companies like that deserve? Companies that treat the public like that deserve to go bankrupt. They deserve to cease to exist. And so I urge you to refuse to buy corrupt discs. Refuse to accept them. In December, I was visiting Spain, and my hosts gave me a record of a local musician. And I was looking forward to, when I saw what it was, I wanted to listen to it. And then I saw a thing on it that said copy control. And then on the back, it said, this can be played on Windows and Macintosh systems, meaning that it cannot be played with free software. So I gave it back to them and I said, here you see the face of the enemy. Please return this to the store because I don't want them to keep your money. I won't accept a corrupt disc. Please don't buy, don't accept corrupt discs. And please spread the word. Please build a movement to reject corrupt discs. If you organize enough people, you can win. But the same movement has to be organizing people to demand rejection of this proposed copyright law in Norway. DECSS must remain lawful in Norway, and Norway must continue to help the rest of the world by supplying us with useful free software to access important published formats. The other law in the US that prohibits many kinds of free software is patent law. In the US, ideas for computations can be patented. These patents are often called software patents, but that term gives people the wrong idea. It's not a matter of patenting specific programs. A patent covering one specific program would be so narrow, it wouldn't even make a difference. Nobody would care, nobody would complain about it, nobody would bother to apply for it, because it would be such a narrow monopoly. But in fact, these patents cover computational ideas, an idea for something that can be done inside of a computer program. Ideas such as the progress bar, which is the subject of a patent issued by the European Patent Office. The European Patent Office has started issuing computational idea patents. But in doing so, it is directly and flagrantly defying the treaty that established it. So these patents are of questionable validity. So you can see now why software idea patents are so dangerous. Because as you could imagine, if a program displays progress bars, that's going to be one thing it does, together probably with hundreds or thousands of other things. And each of them might be patented by a different patent. A large program combines thousands of computational ideas. So if only 10% are patented, that means hundreds of patents applying to prohibiting this one program, which means that when you write a program, you're laying yourself open potentially to hundreds of lawsuits. And thus, far from offering protection to software developers, to mention the word that the proponents love to use, it's software patents are a danger to software developers. If they're a danger to all software developers, but the mega corporations expect to escape from most of the danger because they all have thousands of patents and they cross-license each other. So they escape from most of the problem, and this gives them a kind of dominance over everyone else. So the mega corporations and their puppet government are in favor of software patents. And just recently we learned that Microsoft blackmailed the Danish government by saying that a couple years ago they acquired some Danish company, and that was stupid for Denmark to allow Microsoft to acquire any company there, because then Microsoft made the threat to move that company out of Denmark if Denmark did not support software patents in Europe. So what this shows is that governments should protect themselves from such threats by forcing Microsoft to divest itself of all their operations, sell them off, and don't allow mega corporations like that to acquire anything. Because anything that they acquire becomes a weapon against the country. Microsoft acquired a local medium-sized business and then used it as a weapon against the country. This is what mega corporations tend to do. Don't wait till they pull the gun on you. Work in advance to disarm them, to keep them from being so strong that they can make threats like this. And the way to do this is make them sell off their operations. Don't allow them to acquire anything. Recognize that if Microsoft talks about setting up some kind of research facility in your country, they're talking about establishing a weapon to use against you, and that you don't want that. Tell them, go away. Find some other stupid country. So, in fact, the European Union is considering a directive on software patents. And a broad movement has been opposing software idea patents, a movement that started out in the free software community, but now also includes many other software developers and many software users and economists and politicians that simply don't want to give the big companies more power. And we actually persuaded the European Parliament to vote against software patents. The European Union is not very democratic. The European Parliament has a small role in the decision making, but it doesn't have very much power. So its decision doesn't have the impact that the decision of a parliament of a country would normally have. They don't actually decide what the directives say. However, so far we have been able to block the Council of Ministers from overriding their decision. In late December, they tried to sneak this onto the agenda in a meeting dedicated to agriculture and fishing. And people started suggesting sending the Dutch government lots of fish, saying, what does this have to do with software patents? By the way, the Dutch legislature voted explicitly to tell the government to oppose software idea patents, and the government defied them. We're seeing lots of dirty tricks at every level in this decision. It turns out that the European Union is a scheme that allows bureaucrats to make decisions that essentially can never be reversed. I'm all in favor of political union for Europe, provided it's democratically done. But the European Union is not. So at the moment, as you in Norway don't play a direct role in this European Union decision. And if we win this, there'll be no directive coming your way to pressure you to have software idea patents. But the Bush regime may try to pressure you to do it anyway. So you've got to be prepared to resist this. You have to strengthen the resolve of your government to maintain Norway's independence from the empire, to refuse to obey the empire. Remember that the Bush regime invades other countries and practices torture. The leaders of the United States, if the standards of Nuremberg were applied to them, would be executed. I don't think that would be right. I'm against the death penalty. I believe they should spend the rest of their lives in prison, but no more. And I believe they should not be tortured, because we should not sink to their level. Refusing to allow the empire to gain any additional power and then reducing its power, that is the most important political issue of today. And by the way, how many feet above sea level is Trondheim?
Zero.
Well, the question is, will it be drowned? The US is trying to do that too. So So I'm going to cover a few secondary themes and then finish. One secondary theme is free software and the economy. Now, when freedom to have a community is at stake, the economy is a secondary issue. But it still is interesting to address. If we switched completely from proprietary software to free software, how would that affect the economy? Well, proprietary software is a scheme to concentrate wealth. It's very good at concentrating wealth, which means that the money that is pouring out of the country to rich foreign corporations is not doing much good for the economy. It's just a drain. If people switch to free software, they won't have to pay for permission to run it, which means that that money can go for something else. It'll circulate and probably create more jobs. Now, what about free software and employment? If we switch completely from proprietary software to free software, how will that affect IT sector employment? Well, if we look at the IT sector, a fraction of that is programming. And of that, most of it is developing custom software, so only a fraction of it is developing proprietary software that's actually distributed to the public in user subjugating terms. So we have a small fraction of the IT sector, which is jobs that would be lost. No tragedy. But actually, it's not clear that the employment would go down, because while these jobs are lost, other jobs would appear. And those jobs are jobs adapting and extending free software. You see, the client who's considering using a proprietary program has two choices, take it or leave it. But when considering using free software, the client has many choices. Take it as it is. Don't use it. Use it, but with this change, or with this change, or with this change, or with this change, with this change, or with this change. There are a tremendous number of possible changes the client might decide to make. It's somewhat like buying a building. If a business buys a building, or even if it rents a building, it usually gets the chance to rearrange things, rebuild stuff. But when the business wants to rebuild the space that it just got, it has to hire carpenters. Presumably, most businesses are not construction companies. They have to hire people to do that work. Likewise, if this user wants to use the free program but with changes, well, if this company is not a software company, it's going to have to pay someone else to make the changes. So here we get jobs. And at this point, I have no way of knowing whether these new jobs will be more or fewer than the old jobs. But what is clear is that the proprietary software jobs are found in a few places. There may not be very many of them here. Now, with adapting free software, local people have a certain advantage. It's easier to go to a software company in your own city than to do business with one in another country or another continent. This is not to say that there won't be any international business in adapting software, but there's a better chance for local people, wherever they are, to serve the local clients. What about free software and education? Schools have an obligation to reject proprietary software and use free software. Because schools have a mission to teach the next generation to be capable and strong and to value their freedom. Schools that teach students to use proprietary software are leading them to a life of dependency, which adds up to a dependency for the whole of society as well, making society weak. Students who are taught to use free software graduate as people who are accustomed to freedom and capable of maintaining freedom in their society. This is what schools must do. So schools should reject proprietary software, even if it's offered to them gratis. And Microsoft, of course, and some other companies do offer gratis copies of non-free software to some schools. The reason that they do this is they want to recruit those schools to help them tighten their grip over society. They want these schools to turn their students into addicts. Just as the tobacco companies once gave free packs of cigarettes, hoping that they would turn people into addicts. The school should refuse. Schools wouldn't accept free packs of cigarettes to donate to students, so why should they tolerate these gratis copies of non-free software for their students? Lots of code and writing lots of code. Every time you read something and it's hard to understand, you learn that's not the way you should write it. And, you know, as a beginner, you can't write a large program and do a good job, probably. But you could write a change in an existing large program, and you could make, you know, writing a useful small change in an existing large program is much easier than writing a new large program. So people can start by making changes in existing programs, and by doing that many times, they can learn and get to the point of writing large programs. So schools should be providing this opportunity. They should be using free software. But there's a deeper reason, which applies to all levels of school, why they should insist on free software exclusively. And this is for moral education. See, schools are not just supposed to teach facts and methods. Schools should be teaching good citizenship, which means the spirit of helping your neighbor. So the school should have a rule. Children, if you bring software to school, you can't keep it for yourself. You have to share it with the other kids. And if you're not going to share it, don't bring it. Of course, the school has to practice its own rule. It has to set an example. So the school should only bring free software to class. Now, for more information, you can see our website, which is I'll put you on some kind of mailing list and share it with the Free Software Foundation of Europe. And to help in the fight against legislating DRM in Norway, please support Electronic Frontier Norway. And please get active. Be prepared to contribute your time now. At this point, the waiting is over. You don't have years. You have to build this movement and block that law probably within months. So get active right away. I think handing out leaflets in front of record stores that say, don't buy corrupt discs, and also join us in the fight against legislating DRM, might be a good way of recruiting people as well as making people aware of the issue. You know, it will do double duty. It'll be putting direct pressure on the music factories, and at the same time recruiting more people to organize in the fight against this law. So I will now close by presenting my other identity.
Thank you.
I am Saint Ignatius of the Church of Emacs. I bless your computer, my child. Emacs started out as a text editor, which then became a way of life for many users because they could do all their work without ever exiting Emacs. And then it became a religion. Today, we even have a great schism between two rival versions of Emacs. And we also have saints, but fortunately no gods. Instead of gods, we worship an editor. To be a member of the Church of Emacs, you must recite the Confession of the Faith. You must say, there is no system but GNU, and Linux is one of its kernels. The Church of Emacs has certain advantages compared with some other churches. For instance, to be a saint in the Church of Emacs does not require celibacy. So if you're searching for a church to be saintly in, you might consider ours. But it does require making a commitment to live a life of moral purity. You must vow to exorcise the evil proprietary systems that might possess any of the computers under your control, and then install a holy free operating system, and then only install free software on top of that. If you make this commitment and live by it, then you too will be a saint, and you may eventually have a halo if you can find one, because they don't make them anymore. Sometimes people ask me if it is a sin in the Church of Emacs to use the editor VI. Well, it's true that VI is the editor of the beast. But using a free version of VI is not a sin, it's a penance. And sometimes people ask me if my halo is really an old computer disk. This is no computer disk, this is my halo. But it was a computer disk in a previous existence. So thank you.